So thank the Almighty. This is the beginning of the fifth year of this class.
Given in memory of Blima Pestelbas, Dov Pesach Halevi, and in memory of my late father-in-law, Harav Gershon ben Harav ben Sion.
And this class has a purpose, to find relevant take-home messages in every single parsha. My wife and I present it together, so you have masculine input and feminine input, which is different. It's worked very well for us. We're going to start on page 38. I wrote out some questions in an email just to get people mental juices flowing. And the Torah portion is called Noach. This is what it is. It's called Noach, which means respite or rest. How could you talk about such a tumultuous parsha as a flood and some other things that we're going to go through in the pages very quickly? How could you call it rest, respite, tranquility, which is really what the word Noach means? But I would like to say even before that, this Shabbat, so I started preparing the class. Usually I try to get approximations of where my head is going to go. Shabbat afternoon. And this Shabbat afternoon, I read something from the Rebbe on exactly this point. And it was so personal to me. It touched me so personally that from then until now, I've been apprehensive all this time about bringing this up, because you'll see. Whatever you know about the way our life works, you'll see that it, as we get to the end, it's very personal. We'll find out what it is in a minute. But I said to myself, how could I not share something that can be so personal for so many people and so practical and relevant? So what I'd like to do is go very quickly through some of the tumultuousness of the parasha. The flood is well known, so we're going to skip that, and we're going to go straight to page 56 in the Gutnik Chumash, which is the Chumash that we use. And you will find there in the 20th verse, after the flood. I said 56, yes? Verse 20. And here, I'm just going to read it myself, just to get the main point of the tumultuousness. And I would like to say that this introduction that is about the name of the Torah portion really will be an introduction for anything one could say on the entire parasha. It says, Vayochel Noach Isha Adoma V'yitakorm. Okay, he got out of the flood, I'm paraphrasing, he got out of the ark, and he planted a vineyard. And the sages criticize him. You know, he was called earlier man of God. Now he's a man of the earth. He plants a vineyard. Why do they criticize him? Because, hey, first get life settled. Don't make the extras in life like wine and so on. But then what happens? It doesn't tell us the details of planting because that's not important. Verse 21. Vayishmenaya, and he drank from the wine. Vayishkor, he became drunk. In the first year that we did this 4 years ago, and you can go back to the very first recording, you'll see, actually, on our website, last year or the year before, I don't remember, we did one on Bereshit, because we never get a chance to do Bereshit. So the numbers, it's the second one. But in reality, it's the very first one we ever did. And why did he make wine? You know why? Because anyone who has a flood in their own life, something that really, really overturns them, you're not the same person. Many people after the Holocaust, like, how could you continue living? And I'll never forget, and I've shown this video clip here, I believe more than once. A couple came to the Rebbe, a British couple, and religious people. And they had a son who was on the Pan Am flight that was blown up over Lockerbie, Scotland. And the mother says, in like a German Yiddish, she says to the Rebbe, how can you live after this? Right? And when you see a world of destruction, anyone who ever has had that kind of flood in their life, you understand, like, how could you live? So what happens? Many people, and I'm not saying this is a good thing to do, it's actually not, you find a way to escape where you can go into a place of oblivion. So for some people, in today's day and age, it could be you'll go to gambling and blow your money away, you go into oblivion that way. But Noah, he made wine. You can get drunk because, like, how could you live in such a world? I do want to say, even though this is its plain interpretation, we discuss it at length on that first year. Chassidus goes into this in more depth, even along these lines. The point that I make it specific, because all of a sudden this big flood, which is too large for a human being to conceptualize what it is. It's like, you know, when Holocaust happened, like six million. Do you know how many days is a million seconds? 11 days, right? 6 million seconds is 66 days counted, you'll see. So it's not possible. But when you bring it down to Noah, and he plants wine, and he gets drunk, somehow, you know, we begin to relate to the tumultuousness of this parsha, which is called tranquility. How could that be? And now, what happens next? Nothing good happens from people who become drunk. Look at the very next thing. It says, verse 22, don't worry, but not on the same level. Vayarchom avikanan es eras aviv. So Chom, the son, he saw his father's nakedness, and the commentaries say, well, what did he do to his father? Because it's not explicit. And I'll just give you one opinion, but the giver gives you an idea, that he castrated him. And he said, like, why would you do that? Okay, so that's a discussion. If you get into this piece, you get into it. That's tumultuousness, all right. You know, it's not just he got drunk instead of beginning to rebuild a shattered world. You get into all that. Turn page. Verse 58. Look at the outcome of this event. Talk about tumultuousness. Now, I do want to say something, even though the people around this table and most people who listen to this recording will not need this. I still want to say it anyway. It says here in verse 25, right at the top, Vayomer Noach said, Or Canaan. Canaan is cursed. That's the son of Chom. Chom means dark, dark-skinned. Eved avonim yila echov. He will be a servant of servants unto his brothers. This curse is cited by some people with strange views of life to justify black slavery. That's exactly what they say. But you know how absolutely either stupid or dishonest this is. It's either one or the other. There's a curse here. Guess what? Once upon a time, God cursed man and said, you'll have thorns and thistles. You're going to, by the sweat of your brow, you're going to work the soil. Don't invent a combine harvester. You're undermining God's curse. No. God gave a curse. He doesn't expect you to exacerbate it. There's no, you're going to take, you're going to take an epidural by giving birth? 1 second. God says that with suffering, with pain and all of that, pangs of childbirth. What do you mean? God is giving a curse, but God would like you to minimize his curses. God would like you to minimize his curses. So this individual is cursed with slavery. God would like you to minimize it. So I'm saying that even though nobody here needs it, just you should have an understanding. Okay. But talking about tumultuousness, the result of this drunkenness and what followed, slavery, terrible, absolutely terrible. Okay, so on the subject of tumultuousness, we continue in this week's parasha on page 60, which is two pages. And what do we have? The Tower of Babel. Actually, if it's in Hebrew, it starts just the very last line of the page before, where people had one language, they found a valley, and they said, let's make bricks, and turn page 62. They're going to make this tower, and basically they're going to struggle against God. So what does God say? He says, verse 6, Hover ne'er dolez, descend, v'nov l'ashom sefosom. And we're going to confuse their languages. Ashalayishmu ish svasreu, that they will not hear each other's language. Now that's a redundancy. If you speak different languages, you obviously don't understand each other. But I believe that there's a subtext here. Different languages, different cultures, intolerance. Shall we talk about the tolerance of French versus English or Flemish versus French in Belgium? The first one is here in Canada for those who are listening to the recording, right? And so talk about tranquility in a parsha. We're talking about people who want to revolt against God. And as a result, You know, there was a Jewish fellow a little over 100 years ago. He invented a language. He said, you know, the end to all differences amongst people is a single language. And who knows what language he invented?
Esperanto.
As we go, somebody knows Esperanto. That's right. It never took off. But just the idea, think about it. The idea, for some reason, in South Africa, they speak English. Now imagine if everybody in South Africa spoke French and then came here. It would be a little different. It would, right? It just would be, right? It would be different. So, tumultuousness. So, at the very end, I think we should at least say something that at least nice at the end. Turn to page 64. Something nice happens in today's Torah portion. And it says that, the very first words in Hebrew, that Terach had children and he had Avram. Avram is born. And then two lines down, it says that, there was also Sarah. Sarai, actually, she's mentioned earlier, just so you know. The word Yiscah on the previous page, if you want to look it up, that Yiscah was born. Yiscah is a beautiful name. That was Sarah. Yiscah is Sarah. But at any rate, or Sarai, as it is at this point. So to answer this question, how we could take such a tumultuous parsha and call it tranquility, I'd like to share with you a story of someone else. It's had not only a great impact on the life of every person in my family, but it's actually even had an impact on everyone who comes here. And this is the story. And I'm deliberately not telling you exactly where I'm going, because I want to leave that just for the very end. Because some of what I'm going to share with you now, if you've been around a while, you've heard some of it. And you're going to see a lot of God's orchestration in what I'm going to share with you, but that's not why I'm sharing this with you. Those stories are always wonderful, but I'm sharing this with you for another reason that came to me as I pondered that talk of the Rebbe that I was reading on Shabbos afternoon, this past Shabbos. Several years ago, there was a certain fellow, I don't remember his first name, but he was 47 years old, and he became very ill, and he passed away. He left behind a wife who remained a widow for some 40 years, and I don't remember how many children. However, it's not important, but the oldest, this individual was a mohel, which, you know, I'm a mohel too. So his oldest son, his name is Rabbi Pesach Kron. Rabbi Pesach Kron was a very new, young mohel, but now he has a family to take care of, and he wasn't married yet. And as he himself tells, that sometimes he'd go in to do a bris, and they'd say, "You're so young." He'd say, "Well, so is the baby," right? But what happened before his father passed away was through a whole series of events that they got to know a certain great man in Jerusalem, and his name was Rabbi Shvadron. Rabbi Shvadron was known for his dynamic talks, inspirational talks about the ethical way of living. He would go around the world. And this family, the Kron family, before the father passed away, they got close to him. But then, when the father of the family passed away, he became even closer. He would be there for Pesach, for example, for the holiday of Pesach, in that family. So who was Rabbi Pesach Kron is at the head of the table, his family, and his mother is there, who's still a widow, but who is there? This Rabbi Shvadron. Once he wrote to this Rabbi Pesach Kron two words in Hebrew. Kamoni kamocha. In modern Hebrew you wouldn't say it this way, but it's kind of poetic. It means, I'm just like you. He lost either one or both parents, I'm not sure, when he was a very young child. And Rabbi Pesach Kron, you know, he was the oldest in the family, but he was very young. He lost his father. Oh, Rabbi Shvadron also lost his father. So he understood what it means to be an orphan, and you never forget that. And I want to stick in here, even though I've said it before, and it's very emotional for me to say it even, but I have two sisters-in-law who passed away, So they left children who were orphans. But then one of them, my brother, passed away a few years ago. He was 56. And for my mother, who lost both parents during the Leningrad siege, it was 1942 or 43, whichever one it was, she was 8 years old. And she has told me so many times that it's so painful for her because she knows what it means to be a, in Yiddish we say, keilech dike yosem, like all around, with like no parents. So, and here she has her own grandchildren, and she says, at least when I was an orphan, there were so many orphans because people were dying through the war, right, left and center. It was just the hunger. And here in a so-called, let's call it normal world, and she has grandchildren who are orphans. So this is somebody's personal flood. That's why I'm taking this story. So now we'll fast forward. After many years of the relationship between Rabbi Kron and Rabbi Shvadron, Rabbi Kron asked Rabbi Shvadron, I'd like to take some of your talks and some of the stories you tell and put them together in a book. And the format of this book, and at first I was going to take all of these, all of his books, which we have them all, and put them here on the desk. But the most important one, I realized, is Volume 1. And from the beginning, it was so overused, it's just broken in pieces. It's just, I don't know, I don't even know where the pieces are anymore. It's just so overused. So at any rate, so he says, okay. And he gave it to him to check. And he published the book. It was called The Maggid Speaks. So these are stories told by Rabbi Shvadron. He was known as the Maggid of Jerusalem. Maggid in English means preacher, although when you say preacher in English, it just conjures up a different image. But that's what Maggid means, one who speaks, okay? Like the main part of the Haggadah, Maggid is speaking. Some of his, you know, his signature stories and their messages. And it was an instant hit. Like I said, of all of his books, that's the book that has fallen to pieces. And first, even before most of the other ones were even published. Then, Rabbi Pesach Gron published Volume 2. And then Rabbi Shvadron passed away. But Volume 2 also sold really well. And he began speaking himself. And he speaks all over the world. So much so that for how many years, I don't even remember, but it's got to be more than a dozen years of driving every day to Vancouver. This is in the days of cassettes yet. Right? Right? The DVDs were not yet invented. My children were listening to Rabbi Kron's talks with all of his stories, and sometimes come Shabbos afternoon, the third meal in the summertime, Shalosh Shudas, and my kids when they were all little, they'd make these plays. And they do all of the voice and intonation just the way Rabbi Pesach Kron. I still remember my daughter Chana, who now, thank God, has a couple of kids. I can still see her right here, this part of the room, in her act. And she's just saying what he used to say in one of his early talks. He says, and all you mechanchim, and all, just that whole, she would just do it exactly. So let's just follow the sequence, because we're still not finished. So here's a man who lost his father. And he became an orphan. The whole family became orphans. What a flood. He meets another person who also lost his father. Another flood. The two connected. And what happened? This older one, Rabbi Shvadron, he was softened by the flood. He understood what it means to be an orphan. So he continued with that family for years and years. There's other stories which I could tell about their relationship, but I do want to move forward. So what Rabbi Pesach Gron started doing is publishing, always looking for new stories, new talks, and then he began to publish them. And until this day, I don't know how many books he has, but I think it's either 8 or 9. Now, he has other publications as well, but I'm staying specifically on this path of signature stories with their lessons. Many of those signature stories have become some of my signature stories that I've shared. And that's why, before I started, some of you, you may know some of this, because I'll say this story, Rabbi Pesach Kron, I never forget. He told one story about a certain child who has had a certain mental disability. And I won't go through the story now, because it's not important. But I remember I told the story shortly afterwards. And then we had children came for Shavuos, as we do here, to listen to the reading of the Ten Commandments. And I told that story. And one of the lines in that story is where there's two teams playing baseball, and this Nebuch kid, you might say, right, who nobody wants in his team, but they put him up to bat, and he's barely holding the bat. And finally, somebody from the opposite team helps him, and he just touches the ball before getting strikeout. And everybody's yelling, "Shy, run to first!" You know, they're all cheering him on. How the children of both teams, including the opposite team, they're just doing everything they can for this child. And I still hear myself telling that story all these years. And what I find later on, that story made its way, through the help of one of his daughters, I believe, into a children's book, which of course became it's one of his most famous stories. So here is my point. And I have one more story about this. But this is where I'm heading. Where I'm heading is, the rabbi points out, why a flood? Now, there's so many things to say about why a flood, but what I'm going to say is just a very general thing. In a fresh new world, everybody, the way they were created, they were very set in their way, very firm, very pinklish. And as a result, I want, therefore I do, a world of corruption. This world has to be softened. Everything physical that happens in this world has its parallel in the spiritual. So if you want to soften the spiritual dimension of everything in the world that's becoming rotten, then physically you have to soften it, and you soften it with water. So the whole world gets softer because everything, including people's attitudes, are getting softer. So now what happens is, and this is the point that is so personal, which I'm still going to develop a bit. The Rebbe says, I'm paraphrasing, if you, I say you, I mean me, really. I really mean me, but probably you, because it's probably everybody or almost everybody. When you have a flood in your life, here's a question that if it haunts you for a long, long time, I maintain, at least to myself, that's a good thing. Because maybe I'm in the thick of a flood and I'm struggling for survival, but I have a question. Where is God trying to soften me? So some years ago, the technology was a little bit older than now, but not way back when, Rabbi Kron had this idea that every Friday, he spoke to a group of children who were orphans. And he says this in his talk when he tells about this, one of his recent recordings. I just want to say, because he's a Moel, we've gotten to connect over the years in different ways and speak about different things. He sent me some of his recent materials, which I'm so grateful for. And of course, as you hear, I always share it forward here. He says like this, he's speaking to a group of children who are orphans. And he says, only a person who has been an orphan, meaning to say lose a parent before they get married, understands what it means to be an orphan. And he made a proposition to that group. He said, every Friday, and I don't remember which recording it is because I have so many of his, I wasn't going to go hunting for it before this class to tell you exactly what time and the phone number, which would be nice to be on the recording. But anyway, he says, on such and such a time, on Friday, what I'm going to do is I'm going to prepare every Friday a message of inspiration and a blessing. You know that many, many families in the world, not all, but very, very many families in the world, have a custom that on Friday night, the father blesses their children. It happens to be our custom is that we do it only once a year before Yom Kippur. I'm kind of jealous of those who have the other custom, just being honest. Okay, I don't know the reason. that every Friday night to put the hands on each of the children, the sons, the daughters, and give them a blessing. And he says, every Friday, you know, you don't have a parent who's going to bless you. I'd like to give you some words of inspiration. And I'm going to bless you. So what he's doing is he's doing something that's pre-recorded, and at a certain time, those people who submit their phone numbers, they're going to get an automatic call. They'll just wait by the phone, pick up, and they'll hear him. So just with the technology, that's how he's doing it. Instead of him speaking, it's prepared, so it's going to be right every time. Anyway, how many of the children want to put down their names? I'm going to pick on a number, because I don't remember, as I said. I have too many talks of his to go and find which one it is. So, let's say 2 o'clock Friday afternoon. Okay, so let's say it was 40. 40 of them signed up, right? Because you understand, such a group, you're talking about each one is an orphan, it's a whole, right? And then comes Friday, and 20 pick up the phone. So he was very disturbed by this. You know, he thought he'd come up with something really, a very meaningful idea. And half of those who said yes didn't even bother to call. So he spoke to the woman who actually runs the group, I forgot to mention, for these orphan children. That is a sponsor. That is, I'm sorry, who arranges different things for those group of children, and says, you know, I was very disturbed by just the how many people picked up. He said, she said, why don't you understand? The reason they didn't pick up is because they wanted their answering machine to pick up so they could listen to it over and over again. Imagine. So here is the thing. The question here, and this is this, you can understand why this is just a very impactful talk of the Rebbe, certainly for myself, and probably for most people or everybody. How is my flood softening me? A person can have a flood about finances. Maybe you've got lots of it, but therefore you've got lots of legal. Maybe you have no finances. How is that softening me? And I'll say something about that. Just an observation of my own. When a person, and I'm no holy anything, I'm just a regular little warm fuzzball. So if you're strapped financially, give some tzedakah to someone who needs it. God will shine his countenance upon you. This thought also originated in a certain Sephardic tale told by Rabbi Kron. I don't want to get too far off topic, but I'm saying this, okay? So how is my financial flood softening me? What about personal relationships? Or maybe no, the lack of a personal relationship. What about the devastation of a personal relationship? So we're talking about big floods, overwhelming, that drive people to, who knows, how is my flood softening me? What about children? You know, a person have a flood with children. How they behave, or the absence of children. You know, the Rebbe has blessed many people with children, and they've had children. One particular, I've told this story many times. To me, this is so powerful. One person the Rebbe asked for a blessing, was asked the Rebbe for a blessing for children, and the Rebbe didn't give him a blessing. He said, I also don't have children. So the fellow said, but you're a Rebbe, meaning to say, well, you're in like the highest heavens. What does that mean to you, kind of thing? You're not like me. You know what the Rebbe said to him? He said, but the Rebbe said, I also don't have children. He says, but you're a Rebbe. The Rebbe says, I think about it every single day. And right? The Rebbe passed away. He was 92 when he passed away. 94. He had his stroke 2 years earlier, right? So, and what about the flood of inner turmoil? So the question is, and I feel that if we're haunted by this question, I feel it's a positive, because that's what started happening to me as soon as I read this talk of the Rebbe. How is this flood softening me? So now, why is the parsha called Noach Tranquility? Because the purpose of the flood was to soften the world so that people could change. So that people were not so stuck in their ways, and therefore you have a world that deserves a flood. When God says that I will never bring a flood again, what is he saying? Oh, I made a mistake. Whoops, I just killed I don't know how many millions of people. No. I did the flood. It served its function. I don't need to do it again because people are softened. So that's why the Torah portion of Noah, tranquility. My floods will soften me and bring me, therefore, tranquility.
You were talking about that water was the life. That water is the life.
Oh yeah, water is life. Yeah, that's right.
And I was thinking about that. Also, it represents the purification, I would imagine. So if you think about the flood, and you think about the other purpose maybe, or another interpretation of water as purification, and not only does it purify maybe the land and everything that was going on in the land and human beings,
not only should you not be sorry, what I have to say is that there's a lot more written on that subject than we could ever fit into a class like this, even if we tried, just on an expansion of what you said. So there you go.
So,
yeah, go ahead.
So, we all have our personal flags, to use that language.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think it softens, you were saying, it also softens us, maybe in the sense that we gain compassion. And we become less judgmental to others.
That's right.
So that's sort of softening an individual as well.
That's right. That's why I told the story of Rabbi Pesach Krohn, because it's a story of really big floods, you know, everything that I just said. And even though you can say it's a story about God orchestrating events, which it is, but my point is, look how many people were softened as a result.
Yeah, the outcomes.
The outcomes. It's unbelievable. You know, it's just... Yeah.
There's another angle too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, go ahead.
I'm finished.
Go on.
Like when you add the letters, it's 78, which is 15, which is Hashem.
Oh,
so
beautiful.
My point, just to finish the little thought, that means that Hashem in reality has a hand in everything.
That is right.
Absolutely everything.
Absolutely everything.
No, like hide under the table type of thing.
Yeah,
you can't hide under the table.
No, that's right. You got it. You're right.
Okay. One of the Hasidic words is that the flood came to turn God's judgment into mercy.
That's right. That's right.
And that's really, that's the lesson we all have to take home when tragedy strikes.
Yeah.
There's a Hasidic discourse, and I touch upon it tomorrow. It's called, I'll give a class and then we'll see. Is it on, or do I have to do something?
No, everything's good.
So I thought today that we're not discussing the flood because we've, in the last, see what my husband and I try to do is go back to the last class to see what we did in the other years, and it's becoming more challenging because some of the big stories we touched or we covered or we went in depth. There's always more, but we wanted to move to another part of the parsha. But I did feel that it would be wrong not to at least touch upon the beginning and to touch a bit on Noach. So my husband covered it more than I thought he would. I did want to say that with the rains that we've been having lately and over Sukkot and just today, even before you all got here, I was thinking, okay, we can identify with this marvel. Of course, it's a nothing compared to what they had. And we can definitely, as related to our discussion when people were just walking in, we can definitely relate to the immorality in the world that caused the floods today when leadership gets to such a point where you don't know what's going on. We can definitely relate to it. But that aside, let's talk a little bit about Noach himself. And there's a story of this guy who goes into the yeshiva. He's searching for the best husband for his daughter. And the quality that he wanted most was a real Torah student, someone who was devoted to God and to Torah day and night. And he said to him, listen, I'm a wealthy man. I can afford it. You study Torah. That's what we want in our family. I'm looking for someone like that. And he spoke to the Rosh Yeshiva, to the head of the yeshiva, saying, which boy would be that kind of a boy who could really devote himself to Torah, who's a real Torah scholar? And the Rosh Yeshiva, the head of the yeshiva, pointed out a certain bachur. And indeed, they looked into the guy, and I guess the couple somewhat hit it off to whatever extent that they dated or whatever it was at that time. And the shidduch became, and the couple got married. And the wealthy man insisted that the young man moves from the yeshiva, the city of the yeshiva, the milieu of the yeshiva, to his city, because that's where he lived, that's where her mom was, that was where the family was. And he said, don't worry, I'll support you. You could sit and study Torah all day. Fine. And so that's what this young man did. He loved to study Torah. He would come. He'd get up early the way a young Torah scholar is supposed to get up. He got up in the morning, went to shul early, early in the morning. He studied before davening. He studied after davening. He ate a little bit and he continued studying. And he really kept the day of a yeshiva boy, although he was in a different city and he was a married young man. He didn't have any financial worries. And this went on for a while. He was the only one sitting there in the Beit HaMidrash, in the synagogue. And eventually he started to realize, you know, like, no one's here. It's like 5:30 in the morning, you know. In this city, no one shows up till 10:30 anyway. So 5:30 became 6:30, 6:30 became 7:30, 7:30, you know. And one day, finally, when the father-in-law caught what was going on and he sees the guy doesn't show up till noon, he's still sleeping, and then he's leaving early, and what's he doing in between? And he approached him and he says, what's going on? You were the best boy in the yeshiva. That's why I took you for my daughter. And you're slouching off. And who gets up at noon? So the guy says, but look at the rest of the city. I mean, like, look, who else studies Torah? You know, and he compares himself to who's around there. And that's actually what brought his decline. Why do I tell this little anecdote, which probably was true, or could be, it's an apocryphal story? Noach, in this parasha, is both praised and also criticized. The Torah begins, Eile toldot Noach. These are the offspring of Noach. Noach ish tzaddik. Noach was a righteous man. Tamim haya bedoratav. He was perfect in his generation. And the commentaries both praise and criticize him. Yes, he was a great person. But tamim haya bedoratav, he was perfect in his generation. Had he been in Avram's generation, had he had great people to compare him to, there'd be no contest. And in fact, if Noah was so great and he's the first one that's referred to as a righteous man, as a tzaddik, why didn't God choose him that the Jewish people should come from him? Now, as I said, we are not going into this story that much because we've done it other years. But there are a few things that I want to mention before going on to another story at the end of the parsha. And also another reason that I don't want to dwell on it too much is because tomorrow my subject is focusing on the floods in our life. But let's talk about Noach a little bit. So what was the matter? Why didn't God choose him? You know, if you give someone positive reinforcement, why didn't God say to him, like he said to Abram, come, I'll make you into a great nation, follow me, lech lecha. Why didn't God give him those tests? The problem was from the beginning was that Noach was what some of the commentators call a tzaddik in pelts. A tzaddik in his own fur coat. He was busy with himself. He was a righteous man. He did very good. But number one, if you'd compare him to, say, Abraham, there's no contest. What was the problem? What was the difference between him and Abraham? Do you remember with Abraham how his tent was open to all? Do you remember how when God was going to destroy the city of Sodom. Abraham went and tried to negotiate with God for the rest of them. Abraham took on himself the leadership of the generation. He took on himself not because he wanted, because he had an ego, but because he knew that right now the world needs whatever it needs. The right now God needs somebody to be in defense of the world, so that's where he stood. Or the people need to learn to leave idolatry, that's what he did. Whereas Noach was told that the world is steeped in all sorts of immorality. God already threatened, it took 120 years to build that teva. And yet, he didn't go out there and try to get the people. He didn't go out there and try to capture the minds and the hearts of the people and to bring them back to God. In fact, Noah himself, it says later on when you read the rest of the story, they don't go into the tent until the last moment. What's that about? If you have faith that God said, I'm bringing a flood, why do you have to wait till the last minute? And the commentaries indeed criticize him and say he was lacking a little faith. Is God really going to do this or is he not? You know, maybe, maybe not. So he is indeed criticized, number one, for the lack of faith, and more importantly, because he didn't take on his shoulders the responsibility to go out, to reach to others, to bring them back. But yet, he still was Noach, Ish Tzaddik. He was a great person. And let's not knock it. You have some people who can be lacking in faith and they can maybe have some questions. There's a Yiddish expression for Nakasha Start Minisht. You don't die from a question. People can have questions. Do we know the answer to every little thing? Do we really know it? I mean, we grew up sometimes, maybe not my parents, but other people's parents, you'd say, why do we do this? And they'd say, because this is what we do. You know, God told us, this is in the Torah. Maybe they didn't have the exact answer, but you're not going to die from a question. You don't have to know every single answer. This is what we do. I've said this in other classes. The main thing is that the faith is inside and you can still spend the rest of your life looking for the answer. You know the answer is there. Right? So maybe Noah had a bit of a lack of faith. He didn't have all the answers, but yet at the same time, who was this guy? Spent 120 years building a teva. He was the only one in his generation. He was that lone voice. And because of that lone voice, humanity was saved. Even his wife and his children, really, they were only saved because of him. It says, Ach Noach, only Noach was left. What does that mean? The one singular voice of morality was left in the world. Don't underestimate. Don't knock it. So that's something that this parsha is teaching us. He may not have had all the answers, but don't knock it. Number one, he's a doer. He went and he did this teva. Mm-hmm. Number two, it's because of that one lone voice that the world was eventually saved. So that's another lesson. Remind ourselves that sometimes we live in a world or a surrounding of what might be immorality. Maybe it's not immorality, but it's something's wrong. Something doesn't taste right. Something epishmek nishgut. Something doesn't smell right. Do we open our mouth? Do we not open our mouth? So this week, Noach teaches us, open your mouth. You can be that one lone voice. And for that one lone voice, the world is saved. And even more than that, like I said, Noach was a doer. Because in the end, who went into that teva with that 450-amah zoo, basically, and he was taking care of the lions and the bears and the ducks and the think of the smells, and the lion kicked, and this one roared, and this one quacked, and this one, you know, roared, whatever the different sounds, and the sheep bad, and he had to deal with all of that, to the point, I think one of the prakim and tehillim, it gives a quote, which is basically from Noach, like, get me out of this prison already, right? So in the end, Noach was in the prison with them, with the people. He was a doer. And that's a big lesson that Noach teaches us. You don't have to have all the answers. You have to be the doer, whether it's in respect to opening up your mouth in defense of Judaism or Jewish causes, or whether it's in the matter of mitzvot, doing, just doing. You don't understand everything. You still can be a doer. And more than anything else, at the end of the day, what did Noach teach us? That by the time he came out of the teva, that he has faith that we're all in the same boat.
Mm-hmm.